Hi everybody, I'm Liz and I'm an alcoholic, as will be evidenced in the next 40 minutes. I have a sponsor, my sponsor has a sponsor, my sponsor's here tonight. I sponsor some ladies who are here tonight. My sobriety date is November 24th, 2013, and I picked up my first and only white chip at that time, and I was 59 years old. So I'll be 71 this coming fall, and I'll have 12 years of sobriety this November. Now, I say that because I was doing a little math the last time I told my story, and kind of a sad fact is that my mother died of this disease at 73. So, you know, when I think back about when I came into these rooms at 59, had I not come into these rooms, I was on that downward spiral trajectory and maybe would have 1 or 2 years left to live if I had stayed on that path. And that's a sobering thought, no pun intended. Anyhow, so, you know, I appreciate Tim asking me to do this tonight. I did this after I was 3 years sober for the first time, and it's just amazing to me how so much is the same, but so much is different. You know, so I think this story will be a little bit different than it was the first time I told it. Hopefully there'll be more minutes in the solution than what it used to be like, but we'll just see, you know, where God takes me with this. Anyhow, so I grew up in a big family. I grew up in Memphis, Tennessee. I was the second born of six children. My father was a up-and-coming trauma surgeon, and my mother had been a pediatric nurse before she had six children in 8 years. And this was, you know, in the mid to late 50s, you know, so there were people had big families back then, and we lived in a neighborhood, and, you know, my parents really were both alcoholics, and I like to say they were country club alcoholics, because, you know, there really wasn't a lot of chaos, except for the fact there was a lot of kids, but, you know, we were well behaved, you know, my parents were well respected in the community, but they drank, and they drank pretty heavily every single night, and I thought that was just the normal way to be, you know, so I grew up with, you know, daily drinking as my role model, and I always thought that that was what made you a grown-up. And that's the first thing that I wanted from alcohol, was to be a grown-up. Because I watched my parents drink, I watched them get dressed up to go out to dinner at the country club. I wanted that. My father was a very interesting person, and I have to mention it because it really had such a big impact on my life. You know, being a trauma surgeon, that in itself, you know, probably describes a lot to people who know about that kind of ego. But he was a fascinating person. He really expected a lot of his kids. You know, I used to like to say that we were sort of like the Von Trapp family from The Sound of Music. You know, there was all these kids, you know, and we wanted to please our dad. And when I got into high school, we really butted heads. My older sister, who was 15 months older than I am, was a Fulbright scholar and valedictorian of the class. And it was very hard to compete with her. And so I kind of took a different tack. You know, I was going to be the rebel and a little bit of a maverick. And so we butted heads. You know, he always thought that my boyfriends were too old and my skirts were too short. My mother used to say that we didn't get along because we were too much alike. And I said, oh, well, that's great. That means I'm a narcissistic, elitist, egomaniac. And that was a lot for me to unpack in my third or fifth step. So anyhow, the drinking, I remember my first drink, I was probably 13 or 14, at an airport bar in Memphis. I had a fake ID. I looked older than I was. And like I said, that's what I wanted from alcohol, was to be a grown-up. I wasn't one of these people that really took off with alcohol. I didn't really like the taste of it. I didn't even really like the way it made me feel. I just liked the way it made me look. You know, the drink with the umbrella and, it was vodka Collins and, back in the day of cocktails and, it was a sophisticated thing. So I do remember that, and in elementary school and in high school, we drank, and I was like I said, I looked the oldest, and I had a fake ID, and so I would be the one that would go and get the 3-2 beer in Mississippi and all of that. But I didn't really enjoy drinking it that much. In fact, I was the kind of girl that would pour the drink in the potted plant and make it look like I was drinking, because it was a way of belonging, and that was the other thing that I really wanted from alcohol, was to belong in the group, because like so many of us say, I didn't really feel all that comfortable in my own skin. and the alcohol made me feel like I was part of the group, not the effect of the alcohol, because I still really wasn't all that interested in it. I would pretend to drink. You know, fake it till you make it. I made it. Anyhow, so, you know, that was fairly uneventful. I was popular in high school. I was the editor of my high school newspaper. I was a cheerleader. But, you know, I really kind of secretly wanted to be a bad girl. So I pretended to be, you know, and it's just funny when I think back of it now. I went away to college. I went to Dallas, Texas from Memphis because I wanted to get far away from my dad so that he couldn't control my life anymore, or at least I thought that that would help. So I went to school in Dallas, and I immediately fell into a group of friends that were hippies. This was in the early 70s, 1972. Again, I still wasn't heavily drinking. I mean, we drank a little bit, but what we really did was we experimented with drugs. And this was the era of, you know, make love, not war. If it feels good, do it. Tune out, turn on. The kind of drugs we did were the Timothy Leary variety, mostly. You know, we were trying to change our consciousness. And this group of friends that we weren't sororities or fraternities. We were really into studying auras and trying to get in touch with, you know, get closer to God. You know, we used peyote and acid and mushrooms and all of that. And it was for a spiritual experience. until I discovered one day that I was just trying to tie my shoes. And then I was like, well, maybe it's not all it's cut out to be, but that's what we were looking for. You know, I practiced a lot of yoga, spent a lot of time in ashrams. You know, I was a spiritual seeker. In fact, I can remember being in the fourth grade, or maybe even before that, and just having a real strong spiritual experience, like knowing that there was a power greater than me, knowing with a capital K. You know, so I've always had a real strong sense of, you know, something there, and looked for it all my life. So one of the things I was looking for in drugs and alcohol at this point was a spiritual connection, a cosmic consciousness. You know, we read Ram Dass, Be Here Now, Carlos Castaneda, Hunter S. Thompson, Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas. So I know that that's probably dated for a lot of you here, but that is what we did. You know, we were looking to be close to God. We were, you know, this new free women's lib, sit in circles, encounter groups. It was a very exciting time to be a drug addict. And we had a lot of fun, we really did. And that's where I met my future ex-husband. And he was wonderful. He was so much fun. He was probably the most fun person I've ever known, and super smart. And, you know, if you wanted to go where the fun was, you followed him. And we had just had a great time. And he was a pretty big drinker then. He didn't drink alcoholically, but in college, you know, when people do drink, he was always the life of the party. Eventually we got married. You know, I was thinking, we moved to East Texas, and we both worked in a therapeutic camping program for adjudicated juvenile delinquents. These were boys who were 13 to 17 years old, serious offenders, and they lived in an experimental camping program in the piney woods of East Texas. And we moved to Nacogdoches from Dallas, and he was a caseworker and I was a teacher. It was a really high burnout job because there was so much recidivism, but it was really interesting. And one of the things that the boys had to build their own structures and cook their own food, and they didn't have any entertainment, no phones, no, of course there wasn't cell phones back then, and no music. And I remember I played acoustic guitar, and I had an old beat-up guitar. The bass string buzzed, and the boys gave me a cigarette butt to put in the fret so that the bass string wouldn't buzz. And I was playing, singing. I taught art music. And, you know, again, it was a really fun time. And that's when I first started drinking as a solution, because that job was so stressful, and we had to drive 2 hours to get out into the woods every day. And the other two teachers that I worked with, on the way home, we would drink beer, and we could drink, you know, 6 beers in 2 hours in hot piney woods. And I remember just how that was just a relief. And, you know, I was probably in my early 20s about that time. Yeah, early to mid-20s. Anyhow, I can remember that my wedding week was when I really learned that alcohol could be my solution, because I got married in Tampa, where the rest of my family was living at the time. Husband and I had lived together for 5 years before we got married, but the wedding week was a big deal because, you know, my parents wanted to have a social occasion, and my husband's parents wanted to have a social occasion, so they were trying to outdo themselves for who could have the best party. It was a whole week long, so there was a lot of social pressure, and I remember that's when I really discovered that drinking enough white wine could make me not care about what was going on around me and not worry so much about whether I was, you know, being okay. And that's when it really clicked to me. You know, they say that long before we realize it, alcohol is more than just a mere habit. And when I think back to those years, I was probably 24. It was the beginning of a fatal progression at that point. Still, it was too terribly bad, and you know, we quit doing all the hard drugs, or most of the time the hard drugs, maybe on special occasions. But and I was trying to think what happened next. Okay, so you know, I drank for 35 years. So that's a long story. That's a lot to tell before you get to the sober part, so I'm trying to kind of skip through it a little bit because that's a lot of years. My husband decided to go to work on his PhD in clinical psychology, and we moved to Lawrence, Kansas, which is where he was going to school. I got pregnant and had my daughter in Lawrence. That was in 1980, so you know, some years had passed, and you know, this was a time of my life where, you know, it was fun. You know, we had fun. We were kind of the up and coming couple. You know, my drinking was starting to tick up, but it still wasn't really causing any big problems too much. When we got to Lawrence, my husband got real serious about school, and this was back in the days when you had to go to the computer lab to work on the computer. You know, you didn't have it on your phone, and you actually had to go somewhere. Here I was with a newborn baby, and I was used to having a lot of attention. You know, when we lived in East Texas, you know, I played a lot of benefit concerts, you know, with the guitar and the singing and friends, and, you know, I had a lot of attention there. We moved to Lawrence. I didn't know anybody. I had this new baby. My husband was never home. He wasn't any fun anymore. And, you know, he got real serious about his school and, you know, about being a father, and it was like he changed, and, you know, I was sort of the quintessential frustrated party girl. You know, it was like, where's my son? So I started playing some open mic nights in Lawrence to get to know some people. And that was the other thing, too. I had to go back to work. And my in-laws, my parents, everybody wanted me to teach because I had this teaching certification. But I thought, no, you know, I've got this baby, and I just want to minimize hours and maximize dollars. So, of course, I got a job in a bar. the rationalization of it was, you know, so I could minimize hours and maximize dollars. But, you know, it was really so I could be around the alcohol. At the time, I would never in a million years have admitted that. Looking back on it, it's so clear to me now. It's crazy. So I started getting a little bit of notoriety in Lawrence. You know, people started to recognize me and notice me. And I started playing in a duo and a trio. And, you know, I loved being married. I think I was a pretty good wife. I liked to entertain. I think I was a really good mother. I was devoted. But I wasn't really very good at being married, if you know what I mean. Like I said, I was kind of a, you know, just sort of a minor celebrity in a small town, you know, and so I was getting a lot of attention, just decided that the grass would be greener on the other side of the street, and decided to leave my husband, and that, because he was no fun anymore, and I was getting a lot of attention from a lot of other places. That was really the beginning of a real bad time for me. You know, I was a mother for a week and then off for a week, shared custody, 1 week on, 1 week off. I was in my late 20s. Like I said, sort of a local celebrity, you know, a little more grandiose in my mind than it really was. But I was managing a jazz club there where there were a lot of famous musicians came in and out. So, you know, I really thought I had arrived. And because of my sort of popularity, other, what we like to call outside issues, you know, that powdered form of alcohol started coming into play. And people would give it to me because, you know, I was the manager of this jazz club, and they thought that would, you know, give them perks if they, you know, if they sucked up to me. So before you knew it, I was really out of control. You know, I was up all night. it was a grungy time. You know, y'all can remember, some of y'all I'm sure can remember, that those mornings where you haven't been to bed and, you know, you're gritting your teeth and you just feel like, ugh. And those were the weeks that I didn't have my daughter. And the weeks that I did have my daughter, I had to, you know, straighten up and be a normal person. And, you know, this was when it just got so bad because my drinking self didn't align with my real self. And that created so much conflict that I was so ashamed that all I could do was drink more, you know. And it really, really got to be a downward spiral. I don't know if any of y'all ever saw the movie Forrest Gump. Remember Jenny, the girl? This year's reminded me of that because when I got towards my bottom in Lawrence, I was in my late 20s, and I felt that feeling, you know, that scene where she's standing on the ledge in the big platform shoes and she's thinking about jumping. And that's the way I felt one morning. I remember trying to sleep, and I really just literally felt my life was going down the drain. It was really pretty pitiful, incomprehensible demoralization. But that wasn't my bottom with alcohol. That's when I decided that I was not going to be a drug addicted mother. And I was going to move to Atlanta, which is where my parents were at the time. My dad at this point was chief surgeon at Gregory Hospital. I called out to them. And, you know, that's the other thing I wanted to mention. People talk about their families. And my family didn't make me an alcoholic. They were alcoholics, you know, but they loved me dearly. And they would do anything for me. And, you know, my mother flew out to Lawrence, and we drove my old bombed-up Chevrolet all the way from Lawrence to Atlanta, the baby in the back and the guitar. You know, and it was like, you know, I just cried out for help. I said, you know, I've got to move home. And, you know, I came home divorced with a five-year-old, no money, you know, just, you know, my scorecard read zero, you know, pretty much. It's like it says in the book. But I moved in with my parents. I got a job as a recruiter, which was very difficult, but I knew that I had to do something. I quit the cocaine, which is amazing. The geographical cure allowed me to get away from that, but I didn't quit drinking, you know, because drinking was normal. That was, you know, I was living with my family for a year, and I was 31 years old, so I drank for another 29 years before I came into these rooms. And so, you know, that's kind of what I call the years in Lawrence. I call those the self-seeking years. You know, I was looking for fun. You know, I didn't want the party to be over. And when I got to Atlanta and I thought, pull myself up from my bootstraps, and this was the self-will run riot years, because I already knew at this point that I was powerless over alcohol because I tried to stop and I couldn't. But I damn sure wouldn't admit that my life was unmanageable. No, 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 no. Give me depths, I'll put them in a row. You know, I was determined. And so I just lived with my parents for a year. I got some success in the recruiting business, but I was drinking every single day. I can remember going to pick up my daughter from after-school daycare. I worked at Colony Square for 13 years. It was one of the offices that I had. I would go downstairs to the, you know, the food court, and get two beers to go from Midtown to Buckhead to pick up my daughter at daycare. Two beers in the car. And then I would go home, and I would just have one drink. Rationalization, justification, you know, so I would do anything to deny the fact that I was an alcoholic, or maybe I knew that I was powerless over alcohol, that I had to drink every day, but like I said, I would damn sure not admit that my life was unmanageable. And most of my drinking I did, you know, later in the evening. I never was a day drinker, and it didn't interfere too much with my life, except for when it did. You know, and that was those nights that Jesus, you know, daughter would be in Washington, D.C. with her dad. He had moved there to finish his Ph.D., or she'd be spending the night with a neighbor, and, you know, we'd go out in Buckhead, and, you know, just the things that would happen, you know. I don't really have to go into detail. You all know all those stories. And it was just not a good way to live. And like I said, that this dichotomy between my drinking self and my real self and my spiritual self were getting so far apart that it caused a lot of conflict, and it just caused me to drink more and more and more and more. I, like I said, was a devoted mother, and I would do anything for my daughter. but I could not stop drinking for her. I remember one time she said, "Yeah, Mom," and I'd like to say that I shielded her a lot from my drinking, but you know, the thing about the drinking, even if you're not abusive or chaotic, you're just not present, you know, when you're drinking. And I really regret that. We have a very, very close relationship today, but once she got in high school, it was harder for me to hide my drinking, and she saw that I got pretty drunk every night. And one time, and she was later in high school, she said, "Mom, you know, I think it'd be a good idea if you tried to quit drinking for, you know, 30 days. She'd watch some TV show or something. I said, "You're right. You know, I'm drinking too much, and you're right, and I'll do it." Well, I made it 2 weeks, and one night we were going out to dinner. I was upstairs in my bathroom getting ready to go out to dinner, and she was in her bedroom, and all the vodka in the house was gone. That was my drink of choice. But there was some bourbon in there, and I'd been sober for 2 weeks, and I was getting ready to go out to dinner, and I thought, you know, what would it hurt if I just had a little bourbon? I poured it in a glass and took it upstairs. Sure enough, she comes upstairs, and I saw her in the mirror, and she saw the drink in the table beside me, and her face, the way her face fell, it was just, I'll never forget it. She didn't say anything. She just turned around and walked out of the room. We never discussed it. And like I said, I would do anything for my daughter, anything, but I could not stop drinking for her. I couldn't stop drinking for anybody, you know, and it was when she went off to college, and then it got really bad. The group of recruiters I worked with, we reorganized under independent company names, so now I had my own business and was working primarily from home, and my daughter was away at college, and my life just got smaller and smaller and smaller and smaller. You know, I couldn't really go out and drink socially anymore because I couldn't drink the way I wanted to drink. All those years, all those 29 years, I couldn't really seriously even date anyone because unless they were just a drinking buddy, they would find out how much I drank, and that's just not normal. And that doesn't bode well for healthy relationships. I used to like to say it was because it wouldn't be good for my daughter for me to have a string of relationships. Again, another way to rationalize, justify my own behavior. So anyhow, it just got smaller and smaller and smaller. And I started getting hurt, you know, I started getting bruises. I remember I cracked a rib, you know, I was falling down drunk in my own house every night. And, you know, it just got worse and worse and worse. You know, I had bruises all over my arms, and, you know, I could always say, "Oh, this happened, you know, the horse pushed me," or "this happened," or whatever, you know, I could have an excuse. But one night, I was particularly drunk, and fell in my living room somewhere, I'm not even sure where. But I got up and looked in the mirror, and I had this huge gash in my eye, you know, huge gash in my eye. An inch higher, and it probably would have killed me. An inch lower, it would have blinded me, whatever I fell on. But I realized that I wasn't going to be able to hide this. This was my face. So I couldn't drive myself to the emergency room. I clearly needed stitches. So I called my sister, who's also in the program. Many of you know her. She's here tonight. And it was about 9 o'clock at night, and the miracle was that she answered the phone. Because usually when I would call her at 9 o'clock at night, she wouldn't answer the phone. By this point, she had been in this program for 20 years. And we were really close, but we just didn't talk at night because she knew that that's probably not a great time to talk to me. Anyhow, thank God she picked up the phone, and she was probably over here at NAVA, you know, or somewhere. Anyhow, I said, "I need your help." And I said, "I've fallen, and I need to go to the emergency room." And she came and picked me up, and that was my pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization because I couldn't hide it anymore. You know, the gig was up. I was a falling down drunk, and there was no way that I could pretend that it was anything other than what it was. You know, my life had gotten so tiny small. You know, I had very few social relationships. I drank at home alone every single night. We're sitting in the emergency room. It was just awful. In fact, I remember saying, "You should just take me to rehab." And she said, "Well, why don't you sleep on it? We'll talk about it in the morning." Got home. All right, so at 3 o'clock in the morning, I get home from the emergency room. What do you think the first thing I did? Poured a drink. That was the last drink I ever had. And it was on or about November 24th, 2013. The next morning, I did not go to my first meeting. In fact, I don't think I got out of bed that whole entire day. I had 16 stitches in my eyelid. The following day, I came to my first meeting, and it was right here in this room. It was the Bridge Builders. Julie took me, I remember not much about the meeting at all, but I do remember this big flood of relief that I had. Because, you know, by the end of my drinking, really what I wanted, I was such a power driver. You know, I had to do this big commission job, and I had to be successful, and I had to push, push, push. And I drank for oblivion, you know, that total peace. Obviously, the alcohol quit working, the gig was up. I walked into this meeting, and I remember feeling such a sense of relief. It's like, I don't have to do this anymore. You know, I finally had reached step one. I realized that my life had become unmanageable. You know, when you have to peel yourself up off the floor, you can't take yourself to the emergency room, and it's you're on your face. You can't hold it anymore. That's what began this journey for me. And, you know, it took a long time. And, you know, my sponsor, the first time I ever heard this phrase was that, you know, I was kind of looking for a microwave solution to a crock pot problem. You know, and as much as I was ready for this program and I would do anything, I mean, I would have crawled across cut grass to get sober and to get rid of this way of living that was just not working. You know, that awful feeling where you can't imagine your life without alcohol, but you can't imagine it going on to the bitter end either. So I would have done anything. You know, I rarely have we seen a person fail who has thoroughly followed our path. Well, I thoroughly followed the path. You know, I walked in these doors and, you know, I've always been sort of an all or nothing person, and I was all in from day one. Like I said, I would have done anything. But it still took some time. You know, I wanted to be that woman that was going to be well by Thursday, but it didn't work out that way because, you know, time takes time. You know, this I must earn, and there was so much I had to unlearn about myself and still unlearning, and now learning, you know, how to live it a much better way. I remember being so nervous. I would come to meetings late. You know, right, I would sit in my car until it struck right time for the meeting to start, and then I would run in my car as soon as the meeting was over. And, you know, so all of this took time. You know, those of you that know me think that I'm, you know, well-connected here and that I just, you know, get along and everybody's my friend. You know, I had to develop those relationships by putting the time in. I started service work really, really early, worked down in the kitchen, still worked down in the kitchen. And then the biggest thing was trying to learn how to live life without anesthesia. That was the big thing. You know, this idea of 24-hour segments was brilliant because anything more than that would have blown my mind. But I knew that I could get through the day, come to a meeting, I'd make a big X on my calendar. I had a wall calendar and I would put an X. Sometimes I'd go to bed at 6 o'clock at night just so I could put the X on the calendar and get into bed and pull the covers up. You know, so it's not easy to get sober. You know, it's not easy. And I had to put down the drink and I had to ask for help. But you guys are the ones that helped me. And, you know, they talk about how alcohol blocks the sunlight of the spirit. And I always knew that there was that power greater than myself. But the alcohol and the drugs clamped the water hose and the flow couldn't come. And so it wasn't until I quit drinking that was able to come back to me. And when I realized that that was the key to getting sober, that I had to ask a power greater than myself to help me, what a game changer. What a game changer. Because I didn't have a problem with that, especially once the channel was cleared. Dear God, please keep me sober today. And I still say that every day. And then I came to believe that God could take away the compulsion to drink alcohol every single day. He could do anything. He could take away all these other things that were making me so unhappy. You know, the self-seeking, the selfishness, the sense of entitlement, the blame, the hurt, all of those things. You know, for so many years, I just blamed, ignored, buried, justified, rationalized. And it wasn't until I learned in here how to self-examine, how to look, you know, how to admit, and how to accept that I started to get this freedom that was just amazing. And like I said, it didn't happen overnight, and it's still happening. You know, I remember being 3 years sober and realizing that I was afraid of some things. You know, I never thought I was afraid of anything. You know, I was this type A self-willed person. You take away the self-medication, you take away the anesthesia, and then all the fears and the anxieties that I had to learn to live with and to get rid of, you know, and the same power that kept me sober one day at a time has been able to chip away at these other things that make me so unhappy. So I'm able to live in my own skin as if I were under the influence. But I'm not under the influence of drugs and alcohol, you know, this program has given me everything that I wanted from alcohol. You know, I wanted to be a grown-up, you know, and I finally feel like, I can squarely meet my obligations now. I show up when I say I'm going to show up, except for when I had COVID back in 10 years. I was supposed to tell my story all back, but I was sick. So now I feel like I finally have started to grow up. You know, I still have a long way to go, but I'm growing up at 71. And certainly I feel like I belong. You know, I belong in these rooms. I belong with you people. I have friends outside of the rooms. I have other volunteer jobs I do besides NABA. You know, I have a big, full life. And I finally belong. You know, I'm not a square peg in a round hole. And we have a lot of fun, you know, which was one of the other things that I looked for years in alcohol and drugs. And, you know, obviously the closer to God, you know, I've certainly gotten that too. And, you know, very often a real feeling of peace. Not every day, not all the time, but more and more and more, the more I learn to discard the stuff that doesn't work, that doesn't serve me, and the more I hang on to the stuff that is the good stuff. And, you know, I believe it's all about connection. You know, connection with people and connection with the higher power. I always say that connection treats addiction. Because, you know, alcohol, you know, wants to get me alone and kill me, you know, and it damn near did. And it wasn't until I was able to really ask for you to come in, and all of you, God with skin, and the higher power, my higher power itself. You know, it says this in the book, and I never thought that I would get there, but I am getting there. You know, I'm finding today that the best source of emotional stability for me is not other people. It's my higher power himself. You know, I used to get so lonely. And now sometimes just being alone with my higher power and my dog is the most peaceful place for me to be. And I just never, ever thought that I could be that way. You know, I always needed affirmation. I always needed you to tell me I was smart and pretty and fun. And, you know, now there's this, you know, it's filling up that God-sized hole with real, authentic self and God self and God consciousness and real relationships. And, you know, no amount of pomp and circumstance can take the place of that. I'm going to wrap it up because I'd like for us to have a real time for fellowship, but I don't want to forget anything that I had on my notes here. No, you know, really, I think that, you know, the sense of relief that I have, you know, living the life that I have today is indescribable. And there's a quote in step 12 that I think I'll use to close with. And I just love it. It really speaks to me. And I hope it'll speak to you too. This is out of step 12. It's towards the very end. It says, "True ambition is not what I thought it was. True ambition is the deep desire to live usefully and walk humbly under the grace of God. And I do that with just a little progress at a time." Thank you for your time tonight. What a great story. Thank you so much.
First I slip, and then I clip to a hope-filled dream. Rescue me, and finally, waking there I see. I look into love's window for a soul that's meant for me. Takes me where the promise. Oh. just what we need. On a broad highway, God was tried. We walk eternally. Look into love's window for a heart. Where the